let's talk about the long-term goals. Let's talk about the society-wide mechanisms we could perhaps use to get there, but let's not do that at the expense of making progress.
Welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast. I'm your host, Andre Marder. Biodiversity is being lost at a rapid rate due to the numbers and consumption patterns of humankind. The purpose of this podcast is to contribute towards making the case for conservation of this important asset. A robust case requires looking at conservation from various angles and sometimes challenging conventional wisdom. It's easy to go along with prevailing narratives, but testing assumptions can build their resilience and their credibility. Today's discussion is about the political frame through which people see conservation and the environment more broadly. The media is dominated by liberal and progressive perspectives these days, so I thought it might be illuminating to get a conservative point of view of conservation. Quill Robinson is Vice President for Government Affairs at the American Conservation Coalition and spends much of his time in Congress in Washington, D.C., advocating for what he considers pragmatic bipartisan policy solutions to environmental challenges. We talk about what it means to be liberal or conservative in the environmental sphere and why this polarization exists. Parts of the episode are a little USA-focused and a little climate-focused because these are Quill's geographical and thematic domain, but we also speak about conservation and more generic concepts, and the discussion in general is fairly theoretical. We also touch on a few topics that are sort of left hanging for another discussion sometime, like the goods and evils of fracking and nuclear energy, and the issue of developed countries' ecological footprint on the developing world. There just wasn't really time to get into all of those, but perhaps in future with the same or another guest. For now, here's Quill Robinson. So your background is important to this conversation, especially because your current work and your current views date back to a sort of transition in perspectives that you had a few years back. Could you say a bit about how you got to where you are now, especially with that transition in mind?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think that, as you mentioned, where I grew up and how I grew up are really integral, foundational to where I am today and the work that I'm doing. So I grew up in Seattle, Washington, which I do think of as the most beautiful part of the world. Seattle is nestled between Puget Sound and the Cascade Mountains, and it's just a gorgeous green place full of lots of outdoorsy people. And you know, I was blessed to grow up in a family where we spent a lot of time outdoors, hiking and fishing and skiing. I didn't realize that wasn't the norm until later in my life, but I feel very, you know, lucky to have had those experiences. And so, you know, I did not grow up thinking that I'd be working in environmental policy or environmental politics. It was more that spending time outdoors and this idea of stewardship were kind of fundamental to my upbringing. And so when I got to college, I went to the University of Washington in Seattle. I was studying political science and international affairs. So I was interested in the political realm and international politics, but I didn't get into environmental politics until 2016, which was, as most will remember, a pretty tumultuous year in American politics. I actually ended up working on a ballot initiative in Washington state. So we have this kind of odd thing where a policy decision can be up to the people of the state. And in this case, it was for a carbon tax. And I was attracted to the campaign because it spoke to me because it had this really interesting coalition of moderate Republicans, moderate Democrats, environmentalists, business leaders who were banding together to basically pass a bill that in my eyes would make pragmatic, effective progress on this issue of climate change and help protect what I grew up loving, the environment around me. And so, you know, in sort of a typical college political internship fashion, campaign fashion, I spent all summer knocking on doors and talking to different stakeholders and, you know, got really invested in this campaign. And I think at that point, I'd grown up in a pretty progressive family in a very progressive place. There's a sort of orthodoxy to the progressivism of Seattle. You know, I thought that the biggest barriers to this initiative passing would be big oil companies and hard right climate denier Republicans. That was what I was, you know, sort of grew up thinking about the dynamics of climate politics. And again, 2016 was kind of an interesting year in American politics. But, you know, what was interesting about this is that when an election night came, it lost, and it lost by a pretty significant margin, only received around 41-40% of the vote, significantly less percentage of the vote than Hillary Clinton received in Washington state. And so the numbers didn't quite add up to me. And so, I felt kind of politically homeless after this experience, because I had realized that a lot of environmental groups, big, well-known environmental groups like Bill McKibben's 350.org and Sierra Club and a lot of environmental justice groups had actually lined up against this ballot initiative. And that was surprising to me. It was kind of jarring to me. And so that, you know, that led me to this kind of process of, okay, so who are the potential allies? Who are the enemies? You know, what are the tools that we can use to most effectively address this issue of climate change? And that led me to a very different conclusion. And I sort of saw the right and conservatives and Republicans, although, you know, in the last couple of decades have not had a good history on the issue of climate change, as representing the biggest opportunity in terms of making progress, because I sort of saw this stasis in thinking on the left, this, you know, feeling of ownership and having kind of a monopoly on the environmental conversation. And in fact, laziness when it came to thinking about how to make real progress on the issue of climate change. And so that experience led me to the American Conservation Coalition, which was an organization that was founded by a friend of mine who I went to university with, and he just started it. And basically it was with the idea of giving young conservatives a voice on the environment. That was pretty much it back in 2017. And he just started the organization. And I basically said, sign me up, you know, let me know how I can help. This sounds exciting. This sounds new. And God knows the environmental movement needs some fresh blood and some new ideas after that experience I'd had in 2016 around the carbon tax initiative. And so, I mean, that was my story, sort of my entree into environmental politics. And that experience, I got to say, has really shaped my view of environmental politics. And I think a lot of the same dynamics are still really at play, you know, still really present in the environmental conversation. And so, you know, that's what shook up my worldview and landed me in the place that I am today.
Just one quick detail. Why was it that those environmental organizations lined up against the ballot? What was the reason for that?
You know, that's an interesting question, because, you know, there are a number of different responses and justifications that they had. But I think, you know, broadly, you could characterize it as doesn't go far enough. It doesn't do enough for the most affected communities. Which, you know, I understand, right? Like, climate change is a big problem. Environmental justice is an important consideration. But, you know, maybe if that was an isolated event, I could empathize and understand those concerns. Mm-hmm. Yet that's something that many environmentalists on the left say again and again and again, and have consistently opposed pragmatic action and policies, saying it doesn't go far enough. But, you know, from my opinion, I hope some people probably share this concern, is if every single time we have an opportunity to make progress, we say it doesn't go far enough, that's not going to work, particularly when we're facing a serious issue like climate change.
Mm-hmm. That relates to a question that I'd like to ask you later, so I'll get back to this, but just about the merits and the differences between taking the incremental approach versus, I think you could put the concept of transformative change on the other side of that continuum. So, but let me just ask you a couple of other questions that lead on from what you've just spoken about before I get back to that one. So you're a conservative, or you call yourself a conservative, but not necessarily aligned with the Republican Party, which I think people from outside the US just put those two together automatically, you know, that the Republican equals conservative and vice versa. But what does it mean to you to be conservative, and why do you kind of choose to label yourself that way?
Well, yeah, I'm you know, pretty confident and feel solid in calling myself a conservative. And, you know, liberal conservative in the United States, particularly in kind of the populist era that we're living in right now, is, you know, sometimes hard to put a finger on exactly what that is. But, you know, I see myself as a conservative in the vein of Edmund Burke, of Roger Scruton. You know, to me, conservatism is... Well, I guess I would put it this way. I think that the left and the right, you know, let's just say broadly, like liberals and conservatives, I think the role of the left in a democratic society is to point out what is wrong and call that out and speak up for groups that have not had a voice. I think that's really important. And I think that conservatives, folks on the right, their proper role is to say, wait, hold on, what should we hold on to? What's important that we keep here? And I think there's a yin yang there that you need both in a healthy democratic society. And I, you know, particularly growing up in a place like Seattle, where I saw such intense desire for transformative change, for revolution, I've become very skeptical of those calls for revolution and very aware of the downside of wanting to to transform society rapidly without thinking of the potential consequences. Mm-hmm. And so I think that my conservatism comes from, an appreciation of what we do have from our, you know, political institutions and system here in the United States, but also it's deeply tied to the environment too. My environmentalism is not one of sticking it to the corporations and depopulate the earth or, that sort of thing. It's a desire to hold on to what we have and to be wise, to be stewards of the resources that we have in a judicious and thoughtful way. And so I think that's really my conservatism. I think that also, an understanding that top-down solutions, decisions made here in Washington, D.C. may not be the right decisions for folks in Seattle, Washington, or in Atlanta, Georgia, or somewhere in Iowa, and that people who are on the ground, who are closest to the problems, often have information that we do not, here in kind of the heady policy sphere of DC. So there's sort of a subsidiarity and federalism in the American context, or something that I really believe in too, that local information is crucial to making smart decisions. Mm-hmm. And I also think about it in this, kind of this idea of personal responsibility. The way, Burke puts it is that in terms of our society, but I also think this is incredibly important as we think about the environment, that this is not just about self-preservation. It's about our duty to those who came before us, those who are here now, and those who are yet to come. When I think about why I want to protect the environment, I think about the Cascade Mountains and that I want to teach my kids to fly fish on the Yakima River, like my dad taught me. Mm-hmm. And so, those are kind of like the themes and things I think about when I think about conservatism and why I feel comfortable calling myself that and don't think of myself as someone who's on the left. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting that environmentalism, broadly speaking, and I don't really know how far back this goes, but at least these days, it's kind of thought about not just in the US, but I think worldwide as being a leftist agenda. And I guess climate change has had quite a lot to do with that, but I think that also extends to thinking about the Extinction Rebellion or biodiversity loss. But on the other hand, there are things like, the preservation of national parks, which are perhaps not so partisan. Can you say a bit about that division and sort of why are things seen in that light? Especially why is conservation seen as a more of a leftist agenda than a conservative agenda?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think you have to kind of break down the environmental movement and thought about the environment into eras in the United States in particular. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, we had this great conservation movement. And, I think probably the most identifiable figure there would be Teddy Roosevelt, right? Mm-hmm. The conservation president. But, you go back to the first national park being founded in the 1870s by President Ulysses S. Grant, a Republican, by the way. And there was this awareness that as we were rapidly expanding and industrializing, that there was a need, a duty to protect these beautiful places. And that's how we got Yellowstone as our first national park, the first national park in the world, in fact. Hmm. And I think during that era, it was perhaps somewhat a reaction to industrialization and the transformation of society, but it was also a deep appreciation of creation and nature. And I think that's what the national parks were born out of. And that was an understandable reaction. And for Teddy Roosevelt himself, it was, this New Yorker from a very well-off family who found himself and found solace and peace and meaning as he went out west to the Badlands. And I think that was kind of the first identifiable environmental movement in the United mm-hmm. States that really had significant impacts on, how our nation thinks about the environment and wants to conserve the environment. And that was conservationism in my mind. That was conservationism. And then in the 1960s, obviously a lot of tumult in the United States as well, but there were some specific environmental things that happened that kind of gave birth to this new environmental movement. There's the Cuyahoga River that caught on fire, which is obvious, that understandably causes a reaction.
Because of oil spill, right?
just pollution and chemicals and oil in the water. And there were a number of events like that where it was just kind of a dramatic example of our modern society just leaving a horrible impact on the environment. But it also coincided with the political situation in the 1960s, where you had this sort of radical leftist movement taking hold and the hippie revolution and all of that. And that was, you know, whereas the conservation movement at the turn of the century was not so much an issue of the left or the right, this was something that coincided with a very strong left-wing politics that was gripping the United States. And so that was a knee-jerk reaction to some very real and serious environmental issues in the 1960s. But I think that kind of gave birth to our modern conception that environmentalism is kind of intertwined with leftist politics. And I think, you know, for me, the difference is the conservation movement was about conserving and holding on to and stewardship, whereas the 1960s sort of radical environmentalist movement, which gave birth to, you know, things like eco-terrorism, was a bit more of a radical knee-jerk reaction. Not to say it wasn't justified, you know, with some of the things that were going on, but that I think that's how it kind of got intertwined with leftist politics. And personally, I identify much more with the sort of the earlier conservation movement that was about stewardship rather than reaction and, you know, attacking corporations and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You also advocate for market-based solutions, which is not surprising if you call yourself a conservative. But could you explain what that means just to the novice, perhaps using a couple of examples to describe what that really means? And what sort of mix of government versus free market do you think is best for conservation?
Sure. Well, the American Conservation Coalition, we're a youth group, 18 to 35 is our target demographic. And so we spend a lot of time on college campuses talking to young folks about this. And I think a lot of young people will say, of course, this, you know, the problems we're seeing today are a product of capitalism. And I'm a big fan of history. You know, I love to look at this kind of in the long approach, look back and kind of do some comparisons. I think that one of the fundamental differences you'll see between ACC and the way that I look at these things and, you know, a group like the Extinction Rebellion or Sunrise Movement is, you know, if you look back throughout history and look at socialist economies versus capitalist economies, in fact, capitalist economies have a much better record on the environment. Mm-hmm. And after college, I lived in former East Germany for a while. And I remember hearing about how, you know, there's a joke that there was, of course, like the wall that kept the folks in the communist side of Germany. But then there was also the pollution line as well. There was soot and there was a visible environmental damage that you could see on the east side of Germany that did not exist on the west side of Germany. And so I think so looking back and comparing and contrasting the top down socialist economies versus more bottom up entrepreneurial capitalist economies is why I believe and my organization believes that market-based approaches are the best ones. And so what does that mean? A market-based approach, it's taking into account the factors that are present in a capitalist economy. That's property rights, that which no one owns, no one cares for. If a good is collective, if land is collective, writ large, of course, there's, you know, certain instances where that is definitely okay, then there's a very little incentive for people to care for that. In a system where innovation is rewarded, in a capitalist system where entrepreneurs can make money and benefit from the inventions that they create, there is a strong incentive for them to develop solutions to societal problems. And where goods and services can be traded, there is comparative advantage. So I think those are sort of like the economic factors at play, which are the reason that I really believe that market-based approaches are the best are the best solution to environmental problems like climate change. You know, this is not pure free market versus communism by any means. That's not, I think that's kind of like a, you know, that's an unrealistic binary. Obviously, there's a role for regulation, right? I give the example of, you know, Ronald Reagan, the most conservative president who signed the Montreal Protocol to address the hole you're burning in the ozone, you know, imposing some regulation on these certain types of chemicals, which were causing an environmental catastrophe, you know, that was a good thing. That was definitely a good thing. But particularly as we look at this issue of climate change, which is an incredibly dynamic issue, and there's lots of inputs and outputs, I believe that a market-based approach and a competitive economy is actually going to produce the solutions that are going to get us there. And so, you know, one example I would give there that I go back to, like when I'm talking to college students, is like, look, if we put the government in charge of developing cell phones back in 2000, I'm guessing we'd probably all be carrying around like Nokia bricks at this point. Instead, we have a dynamic technology economy with lots of different companies competing to create the best product that consumers will buy. And so we have, you know, these amazing computers that we're carrying around in our pockets now. Mm-hmm. And I think of, you know, all of the, you know, addressing this issue of climate change is requiring that sort of dynamic innovation as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would also, you know, bringing it to today, you know, moving away from the historical example, if you look at China versus the United States, China being a top-down communist economy and society, they are the largest polluter in the world and their emissions continue to go up. The United States, in fact, is leading, you know, many of the developed countries in reducing emissions. And one of the reasons for that is actually fracking, which has displaced the coal industry in the United States. That was a product of technological innovation. Mm-hmm. And so what does this look like in terms of policies? Rather than the government picking one source of energy and saying this is the anointed energy that is going to solve the climate crisis, we should be creating a dynamic system of tax incentives that do not pick winners and losers, and rather, you know, reward the technologies that work best. We should streamline regulations that are in fact preventing the development of these sorts of technologies and make it easier for entrepreneurs to create the sort of things that are actually going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and create greater efficiency. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of different manifestations of that. And it's not not so simple as regulations versus free market, but happy to go further into, you know, into that if you're interested.
I wanted to actually switch a little bit to something which is perhaps the part of this discussion that I'm most interested in. I alluded to it earlier on, but that was this whole idea of the difference between incremental change versus transformative change. There are assessments that are using the name transformative change. And I've just, in the past maybe 3 years or so, I've just been seeing it everywhere all of a sudden. And there are a couple of things that kind of concern me about it. One of them is that using that term kind of implies that we have not been trying our best to make things change, you know, since the 1960s or 17 or whenever it was, putting to the side all the efforts that have been made already. And then the other thing that concerns me about it, I guess, is that I think that incremental change is, the process is slow and the kind of idea is a slow one by definition. But the way that it works and the way that innovation works is that it sort of crawls along, gradually making ground. And then suddenly there's a breakthrough and there's just an explosion of success and leaps in technology, which just kind of leave the rest in their dust.
Yeah, well, transformative change is certainly, I mean, it's even made its way into corporate jargon at this point too. You know, incrementalism is certainly not sexy. I mean, certainly not in the climate sphere, you know, with the way that the issue is framed. You know, certainly it is a dire issue with, and people's lives around the world are being affected right now. And so I think that coming in and saying that we need to focus on incremental changes can be often be a quite a hard sell to folks. But I also think that it's really important to communicate what you were just touching on that right there. I think something that comes to mind for me is, you know, here in the United States, we have the debate of, you know, the Green New Deal or not, right? And what that would do is spend trillions of taxpayer dollars, you know, subsidizing particular industries and mandating certain sources of energy and so on and so forth. The folks who support the Green New Deal absolutely love solar power. Great. Like that's awesome. But then there's the underlying factor of solar is it's not a baseload source of energy. It's intermittent. The sun is not always shining, but there's been an incremental change that's actually making solar possible over the last 3 decades. And that's the fact that lithium batteries have, the cost of them have gone down 97% in the last 3 decades because of innovation and investment in that technology. And so I think that, you know, by providing examples like that, maybe perhaps that's a way that we can communicate the importance of the fact that incremental change is what's going to deliver this. And I think that's sort of in the, you know, in the economic sense, is that it's not quite as simple as saying put solar panels on every rooftop. There are a lot more complicating factors, nuanced to this. And I think it's incumbent on us to communicate that to people, that we can't just flip a switch and go to 100% clean economy. And that's something that we really emphasize when we're talking to folks about climate policy. In my role here in DC and working with members of Congress, there's also the idea of political incrementalism. And that's honestly, it's also a pretty tough sell right now, particularly when talking to folks on the left who are really, really amped up about this issue of climate and feel a lot of frustration towards the folks I often work with, the conservative folks who don't, in their eyes, put enough emphasis on it. But, you know, here's the thing, like, again, to the Green New Deal, a lot of people don't know that it's just a resolution. It's a statement that's written out that a few people have agreed to, and actually there's not all that much consensus in Congress on. And my response to that is climate change is serious, and I take it far too seriously to wait for that silver bullet solution to come about. You know, we can have our debates on the mechanisms that are used and laid out in that vision of addressing climate change, but can't we also make incremental progress in the meantime? Mm. And I think that that's what we really need to emphasize on a whole host of different environmental issues is, like, you know, let's talk about the long-term goals. Let's talk about the society-wide mechanisms we could perhaps use to get there, but let's not do that at the expense of making progress and wasting valuable time. That's my vision for incrementalism, is saying, like, let's not make the perfect the enemy of the good here. And that goes back to my kind of formative experience of folks on the left passing up a really valuable opportunity to make progress on this issue for the sake of waiting around for the perfect solution. Mm-hmm.
I guess in that case, just going back to your example, I guess it was partly a case of the folks on the left thinking that if that bill went through, perhaps they're worried that, you know, that there would be no opportunity for something better to take its place if something better came along.
Perhaps. I mean, I think also for some who, and I work for a nonprofit, I work in the environmental sphere. Like, I think there are perhaps some folks on the left who get their paychecks by frankly scaring people. And if there is a pragmatic solution that moves the ball forward, that's not in their interest. To be frank, the Trump administration was really good for business for environmental groups on the left, mm-hmm. because they could send out a fundraising email for every single thing he did. Mm-hmm. We come at this from and that's certainly not all, but I think that is the case with some, you know, and that's very different from an approach that emphasizes incremental progress, working mm-hmm. together, pragmatism, finding opportunities for common ground. And, you know, I think that that's an unfortunate reality of the political business in the United States. Yeah.
So you've spoken about these, as you've termed them, unsexy concepts like incremental change, but you've also spoken about unleashing innovation, which sounds pretty exciting. So how does that kind of relate to it, and what does that mean in practice, unleashing innovation?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, the dividing line here is, you know, where are we spending taxpayer money versus where is private capital being allocated? You know, if Elon Musk wants to put up millions of dollars of his own money to try to start an electric car company and see if it works, I'm all for that. Power to him. And similarly to his, you know, his investors, I'm a little less comfortable with the US government making a massive bet with all of our money on one particular source of energy. And because we have a capitalist economy, there is a high reward for those who do, you know, figuratively strike gold when it comes to some new technology, whether it is Tesla or, a new battery storage. I think that the unleashing innovation that we're talking about here is what is happening right now. I mentioned the price decline when it comes to lithium batteries. We're seeing this with EVs. And, you know, another thing here that I think is perhaps underappreciated is that the societal transformation in terms of thinking on climate change, increased emphasis on climate change and ESG and environmental outcomes and that sort of thing, has set up a massive incentive for companies that what some would call greenwashing, but I see as companies genuinely wanting to deliver products to their consumers that are in line with those consumers' values, where climate change and environmental concerns are paramount. And that's, I think that that's a good thing, because it means corporations across the board are really trying to figure out ways that they can produce products that are in line with the environmental values that a lot of consumers have. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, our economy is sort of primed right now to deliver goods and services that really incorporate considerations that they were not before. Mm-hmm.
In Japan, there's recently been a move away from plastic straws at Starbucks. So, and a lot of people have sort of criticized that as being insignificant in the bigger scheme of things. But I think it relates a bit to what you're saying now. You know, if people are sort of thinking in that direction, even if you do get the odd, fairly insignificant idea like that, I think it's part of a general direction of thinking. Just to get back to what you were saying now about unleashing innovation, I understand, and I may have my figures wrong, but I understand that the Biden administration is about to, or recently has allocated something like $200 billion to innovation. I don't know if you heard about this.
You know, it's possible that could be in the context of the infrastructure conversation through okay. Department of Energy. Okay. I guess one thing I can speak concretely about was last year at the end of the Trump administration, there was this big bill called the Energy Act of 2020, which was passed and then signed into law, which allocated billions of dollars. It was a bipartisan bill, by the way. It was the biggest, actually, it was the biggest climate bill in a decade that nobody's ever heard of, but it allocated billions of dollars for carbon capture, nuclear transmission, clean energy, so on and so forth. But yeah, certainly now there is a lot of discussion through Department of Energy and other agencies as well, allocating a lot of money towards this idea of, you know, for specific projects and different types of innovation within the infrastructure conversation, which is
right.
captured the is kind of all that's being talked about in DC right now.
Right. I recently read a book by Matt Ridley. What's it called?
How Innovation Works.
That's it. Yeah. And it's got a subtitle as well, but that's the main title. And he talks about, well, he talks about how important innovation is, of course, but he also says that innovation that's too top down, and that's what made me think about this $200 billion from the Biden administration, might be a lot less effective than the kind of innovation that's stimulated just directly through the free market, I guess. Is that kind of what your understanding is of things as well, is that it does matter where that funding comes from because of the degree of control that could be exerted on it?
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, and you can also think about that in terms of, I mean, just the plastic straws thing you mentioned is stuck in my head now. I mean, if people individually want to use less plastic straws, I'm all for that. I personally am not a big fan of plastic straws. A state or a city or even a nation banning plastic straws does not actually have all that much benefit, particularly in developed nations in terms of oceans plastic. Mm-hmm. Similarly with, when it comes to innovation, I think that and we saw this, there was a case back during in the Obama administration, there was this company called Solyndra, a solar company where, they got some very favorable loans from the government and the company ended up going belly up. And it's the example that always comes up, but it does illustrate a point that because there was such support from the federal government, perhaps the push and pull of the free market and was not exerted over that and it went on too long and that sort of thing. So I think that's a really important point, that small innovations and actually having the pressure of the free market without the federal government and everything that comes along with it looming over that is probably more conducive to the dynamism in terms of innovation that we need.
Right. I wanted to return to that discussion that we were starting about local solutions earlier on. Why do you advocate so strongly for local solutions? And you've answered this in part as well, but could you sort of give the elevator pitch to answer that question?
I think about climate change and what comes to mind for many people when they hear climate change, like polar bears or ice caps, or perhaps, some meeting at the United Nations. And I think that that's an existential threat to climate action. The fact that when people think about an environmental issue, they think about something on the other side of the world, because it's not personal in that case. It's a global problem, but it's not personal, which means that there's very little investment from that person. And that's, that's why I said at the top of the podcast that for me, environmentalism is about the Cascades. That's where I grew up. I have a stake in that. I value it. It's very personal to me. And so in the way that environmentalism has become so globalized and so impersonal, I think that prevents people from being invested in it and caring about it, but then also prevents them feeling like they can actually personally make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the dynamic that completely defines the environmental movement right now. And that's why you have people pulling their hair out, not being able to sleep at night, young folks who are depressed about the climate apocalypse that's 12 years away, is because we've globalized this problem and we've globalized the quote unquote solutions. And so what are people supposed to do? And so I don't think that cleaning up a local park is going to fix climate change. I do think that it will empower people. It will get them invested in their communities. It will create those bonds via those little platoons that they form, and will help create a conservationist ethos in that community that will go from the bottom up rather than this sort of abstract conception of global environmentalism that's been forced from the top down. And so for me, I think that it's almost kind of like a philosophical issue with the environmental movement. And that's why I think that there should be such an emphasis on localism. But then also from a policy perspective, I do think that, you know, this is the what Hayek called the knowledge problem. Centralized government is quite ineffective at creating policy for a local community because there is a lack of knowledge in the situation on the ground. And that's why I think that having federal mandates, whether it's relating to energy or water or any, you know, sort of thing, can be kind of clunky, and that is perhaps better addressed on the state or local level because the electeds, the leaders on that level have a better understanding of the situation on the ground. So it's primarily a philosophical issue for me, but then I think there's also a practical governance issue as well, where folks are better equipped to or closer to the problem.
Mm-hmm. You touched on the whole doom and gloom thing there, and that was something that I have been in one way or another very much focused on for most of my life, I think. And I think it's caused me a fair amount of misery, you know, this whole idea that the planet is coming to an end. And the more I think about it, the more critical I think it is that we abandon that doom and gloom idea. And I think there are two reasons for that. The one is, quite frankly, things are not quite as bad as a lot of the most extreme voices are making them out to be. They're bad, but they're not quite as bad. And then the other thing is, of course, it cripples people. And similar to what you were saying, everything that's going wrong, and then you're just one out of 7-8 billion people, what are you supposed to do about it? I don't know how anybody can hear that kind of stuff and not be disabled to do anything about it.
Yeah, well, it's concerning to me. It's scary to me that so many young people are really crippled by their fear of climate change and environmental catastrophe. I had the opportunity to meet Greta Thunberg a couple of years ago now. My boss testified with her in front of Congress. And I just think, like, you know, on one side you have these adults stoking the fear and telling young folks that the world is going to end. And then you have other older folks saying there's no problem at all, and you're a brainwashed, dumb little kid. Mm-hmm. What the hell is that? I mean, it's messed up. And I remember when I first learned about climate change, I went and saw An Inconvenient Truth with my family. I guess that was like 2006. So I was 11 years old at that time. For our generation, we've learned about it since elementary school. Hmm. So no wonder that it is one of the prime concerns of young people around the world. It's always been present, just like our, you know, cell phones or social media for us. It is a present threat and challenge. But there's been an amplification of this threat. And I think it's really unfortunate because we shouldn't be making young people more depressed. That's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Or messing with their mental health. But also it's just really not conducive to moving towards solutions.
Right.
It's a sort of learned helplessness, you know, sharing this collective anguish and nihilism about the future of the world. And it really is pernicious when it comes to young people around the world. Mm-hmm. It really is present in the conversations that they're having. And, you know, as you said, like from the latest reports that we're getting, the latest IPCC report says the worst case situations and the best case situations are less likely. You know, we're not facing a global catastrophe tomorrow. It's also a serious threat that we need to address. And I think back to, you know, my grandparents lived through World War II. You know, each generation has fought their battles and overcome them, and learned helplessness and nihilism have never been what has gotten them through. It's a determination and commitment to address the problem and a steadfastness. And so I think that we need a complete culture shift when it comes to this issue of climate change. And many of the adults who are peddling this fear need to really check themselves. But we also, and this is something that my organization is really focused on, is accurately characterizing the challenge we face, but also equipping young people with the tools and language to talk about the solutions. Because that's what we need to focus on, is the solutions. And so that's, you know, that's how we're thinking about it. But I really do hope that there's a culture shift around this issue and a focus on solutions and a commitment to progress rather than, you know, continuing to go deeper into this depression and fear and nihilism about the issue. Where it gets political is when those people turn around and are opposing nuclear energy. or preventing pragmatic legislation from getting passed because it doesn't go far enough, who are saying that carbon capture is, you know, greenwashing for fossil fuel companies, those who are making the perfect and the enemy of the good, delaying action and progress, and then turning around and stoking fear. That's where it gets problematic, and that's where it's clearly political. And that needs to be called out. I also think that, you know, we are living in the most prosperous period on Earth. 1 billion people have been lifted out of poverty in the last 40 years. We are living relatively very comfortable lives in the West. And, you know, perhaps people are filling a God-sized hole with some other, you know, some other God and some other devil. I think that might be playing a role as well. But we need to look at climate change for what it is, the threat it poses, and focus on what actually is going to address that issue.
Something that I've really only quite recently begun to appreciate is how fragile many of those things that you listed now that we have come to take for granted actually are. Democracy, for example, you know, I think is one of those. We kind of take it for granted as just being the norm, the natural way of things, but it's actually going against the grain of human nature. And it's quite a miracle that we have it. So I kind of, and I think this is one of the reasons why I have time for the kinds of arguments that you're making, and this whole idea of looking at what we have, and sure, we can move forward, but let's not tear it down before we've very carefully evaluated how valuable it is, because we really don't know that we can replace it with something better. I think that's kind of what it boils down to. There's an amazing documentary, and I've only seen clips of it. I haven't watched the whole thing yet, but it's called They Shall Not Grow Old. So, do you know about it? Have you seen it? Okay. Yeah. So, that just kind of, I mean, just seeing the clips. So just for those who are listening and who haven't seen it, Peter Jackson, the guy who did Lord of the Rings, remade, or it's kind of like a documentary without narration, right?
I think there's some narration to it, but okay. I mean, the really remarkable thing about it is that it's colorized videos, which are slowed down and kind of edited from the First World War.
Right. Actual footage that they have cleaned up to make it look like it was done yesterday, basically. And they've even got lip readers to see what people were saying, and then they've dubbed it in so that you can kind of hear what they would have been saying and all that kind of thing. But looking at the sacrifice that those people made, and that's just one example of many, to kind of keep things afloat. And, you know, things can so easily fall apart. That is the natural tendency of things. That's entropy.
And speaking of, you know, entropy and the fragility of democracy, I watched January 6th happen from my, you know, from my window,
the
insurrection. And in that case, it was from the right that had no respect for, you know, the fragility of it all. But
a
powerful illustration of what you're describing.
I think that there's a lot to be said for keeping things together until we really know that taking them apart is going to improve things.
I think that it is not absolute resistance to progress. It is avoiding progress for progress's sake, and it is taking it slowly and incrementally and thoughtfully so that we understand what we may lose by progressing too quickly. You know, there's this concept, G.K. Chesterton's fence. A conservative and a liberal are walking through a field. They come across a fence. The liberal says, tear it down. Let's move past. And the conservative says, why don't we figure out why it's here first before we do that?
Okay, that's it from Quill. I hope you enjoyed the chat. Next month's discussion is not completely confirmed yet, but I plan to cover the topic of general awareness of biodiversity and conservation, and the importance of conservation when compared with other global priorities. My guest is Stephen Lowe, who has had a varied career covering first cardiovascular research, then conservation biology, and now science education. I find him a fascinating human being, and I hope you can join our discussion.